I tried to ask myself, should I see someone else? I wish I knew the answer, but I know if I go now, if I leave, and I'm on my own tonight, I'll never know the answer. Midnight doesn't last forever. Find your lips so kissable, and your kiss unmissable, your fingertips so touchable, and your eyes irresistible. It's in all the things and other things that make you who you are, in your eyes, irresistible.
What's up, everybody? This is DJ Liberty here on my show Political Row on the one and only radio.dominican.edu on Penguin Radio. I want to say a happy St. Patrick's Day out there. Hope everybody's being safe. But let's get down to my show. Today, we will be talking about some international, national, and state news, state being California news. We will be discussing this first segment about some international news having to do with China, Israel, the Malaysian airline, they went missing, some Ukraine, and Russia having to do with Ukraine's situation. So, to kick it off here on Political Row, Obama is going to meet with the Chinese president on the sidelines of the Nuclear Security Summit, which is being held next Monday and Tuesday in the Netherlands. And one likely topic that will be discussed is Russia's military incursion into Crimea and possible efforts to annex the Ukrainian region. President Obama is traveling to Europe next week, and this trip will also include a stop in Rome to meet with Pope Francis. Moving on, Obama is challenging, it's meeting the challenges ahead in the Israeli-Palestinian talks with Abbas, seeking to inject fresh energy into Israeli-Palestinian peace talks. President Obama met with Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas Monday and urged him to embrace the chance for peace. The talks, which have started to stall ahead of an April deadline set by the U.S., have largely been led by Secretary of State John Kerry. Mr. Obama has stepped in to urge leaders on both sides to keep working, meeting with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu earlier in March as well. Speaking to reporters before his meeting with Abbas Monday, Mr. Obama praised the Palestinian leader as, in quotes, somebody who has consistently renounced violence, who has consistently sought a diplomatic and peaceful solution. Still, he noted that peace is an elusive goal with many challenges that remain ahead. We remain convinced that there is an opportunity, and I think everybody understands the outlines of what a peace deal would look like, the president said. I believe now is the time for not just the leaders of both sides, but also the people of both sides to embrace this opportunity for peace. But we're going to have a lot of details when we're going to need to get this discussed. Abbas thanked the president for the economic and political support the U.S. has provided and stressed that he is aware of the urgent nature of peace talks. We don't have any time to waste. Time is not on our side, he said through a translator. Though the negotiations have been private and full of contentious issues, one that has erupted publicly in recent weeks is whether the Palestinians will recognize Israel as a Jewish state has been the subject of public tension recently. During his meeting with Mr. Obama at the beginning of March, Netanyahu said it was about time they recognized a nation state for the Jewish people. We've only been there for 4,000 years. Abbas is under pressure back home not to recognize the Jewish nature of state, as it is seen as a concession to Israeli demands that Palestinians give up so-called right of return for refugees to come back to parts of Israel. The Palestinian leader said last month that, I am not looking to drown Israel with millions of refugees to change its nature, though it is unclear his views are widely shared by the rest of the population. As the press was leaving the Oval Office, CBS News White House correspondent Mark Noller asked the president if he realized it was also snowing on the day Netanyahu visited, and the president said it's a sign. Now, this whole talk with Israeli-Palestinian issues is kind of interesting because, I mean, it's been going on for quite a while now, and as I stated earlier, the president and the Palestinian leader both said that time is not on their side, and it really isn't. It seems as though a lot nowadays, and it's, you know, it's always happened around the world, is striving for peace with whether it's refugees or just different religious groups, however you call it, in a nation. I think there needs to be peace and order in Israel, and I think everybody needs to be recognized regardless of their religious views. Now, how it is resolved, it needs to be peaceful. It can't be anything like I'm going to talk about a little bit later, where Ukraine and Russia have had a little bit of a tiff, I guess you could say, but I mean, it's way more than a tiff, but that's the last thing that more countries over in Europe, near Asia, just near the Middle East, that's the last thing that those countries need. Now, moving on. The Malaysia Airlines Flight 370 has gone missing. This has been a huge topic as of late. I'm sure everybody has heard about it. But the post-disappearance move suggests sophisticated handling, which is said by many experts around the world, not even just in the U.S., even with new information about the fate of Malaysian Airlines Flight 370 coming to light Sunday, experts say that the plane's disappearance is still shrouded in mystery and might never even be found. A week after this plane went missing, nobody can tell us with any authority where it went or why it went where it did. and now it's just a painstaking process where patience is going to be required for people who want answers right now. Earlier in the day, Malaysian officials revealed that the plane's data communication system had been partially disabled prior to the final communication from the plane's cockpit. The pilots did not indicate any trouble on board, suggesting a possible intent to mislead ground control. They have now become a central part of the investigation, along with all ground staff, crew, and even the passengers. Although it's still too early to draw conclusions about a potential hijacking or rogue pilots, evidence shows that the plane changed course and altitude and flew for a long time after the last communication with ground control, suggests a level of sophistication by whoever was controlling the plane. That brings up the question, if it's rogue pilots, then that is obviously completely plausible. Or if it was a hijacking, these hijackers must be trained to fly commercial planes like this very large Malaysian airline commercial flights. Captain Chesley Sullenberger, the CBS News aviation and safety expert, said there will be great efforts and huge sums to solve the mystery. Though it could take months or years to understand what happened if investigators are unable to find the plane. Now that's crazy, taking months or years to find out what happened to an airplane. This whole situation is crazy, and the fact that an airplane has just gone missing is out of this world. It's unreal. Granted, I'm only 19, but I've never heard of a plane like this just go missing. The aviation industry never normally tolerates this level of ambiguity. And the real frustration that we are learning about this very late in the process, and with the passage of time, it makes variability in the search much greater, and it makes it much harder, ultimately, to find out what really did happen. Many possibilities verge on a spy novel kind of situation. Overall, it's still too early to draw conclusions given the lack of physical evidence. This plane may still be at the bottom of the Indian Ocean, and I think a lot of folks that I talked to, probably most likely think that under the circumstances, it is at the bottom of the Indian Ocean, but you can't rule anything out. It could have been hijacked by very skilled pilots. Rogue pilots could have landed it somewhere, but it's just so hard to determine what happened, because if it's going to be landed at an airport, it's going to be found. So what could happen to it? I know I saw earlier in the weeks a piece of what looked like what was part of the plane was found in the Indian Ocean. Now, I don't know if that shows or foreshadows anything about the plane going into the Indian Ocean, but it sure does cause a little bit of duress, and what's already caused so much pain and hurt for families out there that have lost loved ones on this plane gone missing is terrible. There's a lot of chance that there will never be any physical evidence of this plane ever being found. And as time goes on, with an area this large to search, I think it is possible that it's hard to believe and that we may never find this plane. And if it's not found, it's going to cause huge problems. If you lose a plane, that just raises so many questions about airline safety. It's just such a scary thought to think that you could go up in the air like that, especially after attacks here in the U.S. on 9/11, after all the security checks and everything like that, that a plane could just go missing and vanish just like this. Now, it's been said that maybe there's a red herring here with terrorism and this missing airline. The revelation that the Malaysia Airlines Flight 370 communication system that was partially disabled prior to the final communication, it shows and raises questions about why it disappeared. One in particular is to a nation that has seen what can happen when a plane is hijacked, like the U.S. on 9/11, like I just mentioned. Although it seems increasingly likely that there was foul play and the search has honed in on the pilots, There has still been no indication, such as a claim of responsibility or anything like that, that there was an attack planned by a terrorist group. So that's the only thing that rules out kind of a terrorist attack or something of that nature, but it still just looms in everybody's minds that, wow, how could this happen? If there's nothing that indicates a single thing about these pilots that were flying this plane, then how could it be rogue pilots? I mean, that would be a very good under-the-table, sneaky, undercover job by these pilots, but where it's just a question of where did this plane go? Many folks right away want to jump to the motive of terrorism, but it may not have anything to do with terrorism, said Ken Maxwell, who headed the FBI's counterterrorism unit during 9/11. You would think, if you want to speculate some more, that if this was a terrorist-related incident, something would have come up on the screen by now, something from somewhere, even just a little tidbit, a little intercept, or some email somewhere, which completely makes sense. I mean, if it's a terrorist attack, you're not going to take an airplane and not say who took it, what terrorist group took it, what can happen to this airplane if so-and-so doesn't happen. It's just, it seems like if it was a terrorist attack, there would be communications. Like he said, there could be an email somewhere. Something would have popped up on the television by now. It's just, it's crazy. With no sightings of the plane or wreckage spotted in the 9 days since the plane disappeared during a flight from Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia to Beijing, China, very little has been ruled out. So everything is on the table here with this missing plane. Obviously, I hope it gets found. I mean, at this point, though, basically a week later, what is there to happen? I mean, what could happen now? What could turn up? It's crazy what could have possibly happened to this flight. How long could it have been flying for? Where could it have flown? Where could it have landed if it didn't land in an airport? Is it in the water? Is it at the bottom of the Indian Ocean? It's just so crazy. So many questions. Terrorist group, rogue pilots, whatever it is, it's a nuts situation. Now, not last week because of our spring break here at Dominican, but the week before, I discussed a majority of my show about Ukraine and the interventions with Russia and the United States. Now, with this change of topic here, the Ukraine crisis is becoming a bigger and bigger deal as the U.S. rejects bogus secession votes in Crimea, citing Russian meddling. As residents of Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula vote Sunday on whether the region should maintain ties with Ukraine or secede, and with early exit polls suggesting a strong inclination towards secession, U.S. lawmakers and administration officials rejected the legitimacy of the ballot referendum, vowing not to recognize any result that violates Ukraine's territorial integrity or sanctions Russia's incursion into the peninsula. In quotes, "We reject the referendum that took place today in the Crimean region of Ukraine," explained a statement from the White House on Sunday. "This referendum is contrary to Ukraine's constitution, and the international community will not recognize the results of a poll administered under threats of violence and intimidation from a Russian military intervention that violates international law. In this century, we are long past the days when the international community will stand quietly while one country forcibly seizes the territory of another," the statement added. Now, this is an interesting statement because it immediately attacks Russia for being the bad guy in this situation by violently intimidating the Ukrainian residents with their strong military presence on the Crimean Peninsula. President Obama personally weighed in on the secession vote on Wednesday during a meeting with Ukrainian's interim prime minister, saying the U.S. would not recognize the slapdash referendum and vowing to stand firmly behind the Ukrainian government. Now, it's nice to hear that Obama is speaking out and saying that we're standing by the Ukrainian government. He states out our position with this and basically going against Russia and their military in the Crimean Peninsula. Senator John McCain, the Republican from Arizona, who led a bipartisan group of senators to meet with the new government in Ukraine this week, similarly dismissed Sunday's vote in Crimea as bogus, but he added that the probable result, a vote to secede, is not very much in doubt. I think in the short term, clearly now with the overwhelming military superiority and the actions that Putin has taken, you can't say that there is anything but a fait accompli, he said on CNN. But having said that, that doesn't mean that somehow say, okay, you, Vladimir Putin, can have a major part of a country, that your country itself sign an agreement in return for Ukraine's returning their nuclear capabilities, that they guarantee the territorial integrity of it. Look, it is a bogus thing, McCain added. We used to call it plebiscite in the days of Hitler and Stalin. As the standoff continues, President Obama's administration and some in Congress have been pushing for an aid package that would provide some relief to Ukraine's ailing economy and sanction Russia for its military incursion in Crimea. On Sunday, the top lawmakers on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, which passed such a bill on Wednesday before Congress left for D.C. for a week, described the aid package as a step in the right direction. The sanctions that we passed out on the Foreign Relations Committee the other day are very biting, one of a kind, said Senator Bob Corker, Republican from Tennessee, the top Republican on the committee. We've never done this before where economic extortion and corruption are part of those, he added. Now, committee chairman Senator Bob Menendez, the Democrat from New Jersey, said threat of sanctions would put some muscle behind U.S. negotiations as they seek to defuse the crisis and prevent further Russian aggression. Now, we're going to take a quick short break here on my show, Political Row. You're with DJ Liberty on one and only Penguin Radio.
Song. Woo-hoo!
What's up, everybody? This is DJ Liberty back here on my show, Political Row, on the one and only Penguin Radio. Now, we are going to continue just a little bit more on some international stuff having to do with Russia and Ukraine and the Crimean vote. Now, Obama announced today that, or yesterday, that the sanctions against Russian officials came after the Crimean vote. President Obama on Monday publicly condemned the results of a referendum in the Crimean Peninsula to secede from Ukraine as illegitimate and announced his administration was pursuing sanctions against top Russian officials as a consequence. "We're making it clear that there are consequences for their actions," the president said, and he warned, "If Russia continues to interfere in Ukraine, we stand ready to impose further sanctions." The administration has maintained for weeks that the vote was a violation of the Ukrainian Constitution and therefore illegitimate. In his statement from the White House Monday, the president said it would not be recognized by the international community. "Continued Russian military intervention in Ukraine will only deepen Russia's diplomatic isolation," he said. The new penalties build on an executive order from the White House earlier this month that imposed visa restrictions on pro-Russian opponents of the new government in Ukraine, bringing the total number of individuals facing sanctions to 11. Wow. Senior administration officials who briefed reporters on the order described the targeted individuals as cronies of those Russian government and arms industry who had taken a leading role in envisioning or implementing the referendum strategy, including former Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych. "Today's actions send a strong message to the Russian government that there are consequences for their actions that violate the sovereignty and territorial integrity of Ukraine, including their actions supporting the illegal referendum for Crimean separation," the White House said in a statement. A senior administration official later called the action far the most comprehensive sanctions applied to Russia since the end of the Cold War. The European Union also announced Monday it would freeze assets of and ban travel for 21 officials in Russia and Ukraine. Although that list has not yet been released, a senior administration official indicated that there would be some overlap between the two groups. During a briefing later in the day, White House Press Secretary Jay Carney refused to rule out the possibility that Russian President Vladimir Putin might be the target of future sanctions. Although the White House is using sanctions to punish Russia, it is still seeking a diplomatic resolution to the conflict in Ukraine. After the results of the referendum Sunday, in which 97% of voters backed secession and an ultimate reunification with Russia, Mr. Obama spoke with Putin to reprimand him for supporting the referendum and say there could be no resolution as long as Russian troops continue to remain inside Ukraine and conduct military exercises on the border. I completely agree with Mr. Obama here, especially because it's in Ukraine's constitution that they cannot hold a vote like this when there is some kind of military force exercising power to intimidate those that are voting here in the Crimean Peninsula. Like, that is not what is stated in their constitution, so that is not okay to do so, and it is completely legitimate for the U.S. and for anybody else in the world to deny any of what they have voted on as being legitimate. The president said Monday that the U.S. would calibrate its response based on whether Russia chooses to escalate or de-escalate the situation. Mr. Putin has shown no willingness to back down, however, and is scheduled to address the Russian Federal Assembly Tuesday. It is widely expected to recommend formal annexation of Crimea, according to the administration. The Crimean Peninsula had been a part of Russia until about the 300th anniversary of Russia's acquisition of Ukraine, until 1954 to mark the 300th anniversary of Russia's acquisition of Ukraine. That was back when it was under the USSR. Now, we are going to move on to some national news here in the United States. We're going to start off with some fun stuff having to do with the White House and Obama and some sports-related things that are coming out. Now, the White House has harnessed March Madness to even promote Obamacare. In a last-ditch effort to appeal to the young and uninsured ahead of the March 31st deadline, the White House is modeling their final weeks of promoting the law after the NCAA March Madness basketball tournament. Starting today, Monday, the administration will release a bracket called 16 Sweetest Reasons to Get Covered and encourage people to vote for the best reasons. Along with the bracket, they'll push out a video featuring two of the most recognized coaches in college basketball talking about the importance of getting health insurance and making sure consumers know about the upcoming March 31st deadline, according to a White House official. Now, this is actually a very good marketing technique taken by the White House. Everybody watches March Madness. Whether you watch college basketball during the season or not, you're watching March Madness. You're wanting to make a bracket. Putting this type of ad that goes along with making a bracket for something that's like a Sweet 16, and they call it the 16 Sweetest Reasons to Get Covered, that's very catchy and a very good marketing technique taken here by the White House and by Mr. Obama to get Obamacare out there to the public, to know when the deadline is, and to try and gain more support. The Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services will also air an ad featuring LeBron James on ESPN, ABC, TNT, and even NBA TV, adding to a rotation of existing ads that feature other basketball stars such as Magic Johnson and Alonzo Mourning. The Health and Human Services Department will focus their social media promotion around the tournament as well, including tweets from the Secretary and other top administration officials who will also call into sports radio stations across the country. The outreach will be critical to boost the number of younger Americans who sign up for coverage on the exchanges, since they tend to be healthier and therefore cheaper than older enrollees. 1 month before the end of open enrollment, just 25% of the 4.2 million people who had signed up for coverage were in the 18 to 34 age bracket. That number would need to be closer to 40% to make the marketplaces sustainable. According to a survey by Bankrate.com, 46% of people are still unaware of the deadline for signing up, and a third of Americans without health insurance plans to stay that way, citing the cost for insurance as the most common reason for not signing up. As a result, the administration has stepped up efforts to reach young people. Last week, President Obama appeared on the comedy web show Between Two Ferns with Zach Galifianakis. Now, the Obama administration and the White House is trying to make a last-minute push here, and I think, you know, even though it hasn't gotten much support and they obviously haven't done a very good job marketing Obamacare, I think they're now doing employing a very good technique to reach younger people as they're putting ads on March Madness, and how President Obama appeared on Between Two Ferns with Zach Galifianakis. That is a great technique used by Obama and the White House to get Obamacare out there. Make sure everybody knows the deadline. Make sure the support for them is out there. Now, whether you agree with Obamacare or not, you have to understand that this is a very good technique taken by Mr. Obama. And on Mr. Obama and his creative ways, Obama has defended his dad's jeans. President Obama, to this day, gets lampooned for the horrible jeans he wore to throw out the first pitch at the 2009 MLB All-Star Game, but the president insists he's gotten a bad rap. "I've been unfairly maligned about my jeans," Mr. Obama joked Thursday on the radio show On Air with Ryan Seacrest. "The truth is, generally, I look very sharp in jeans," he said. "There was one episode like 4 years ago in which I was wearing some loose jeans mainly because I was out on the pitcher's mound and I didn't want to feel confined while I was pitching, and I think I've paid my penance for that. I got whacked pretty good. Since that time, my jeans fit very well." The subject came up because the president recently missed a good opportunity to update his look. He recently stopped at the Gap in New York City to applaud the retailer's decision to raise its employees' wages. He made some purchases for first Lady Michelle Obama, and their daughters, but he didn't buy any new jeans for himself. The 2009 baseball game wasn't the only time the president was caught wearing less than flattering jeans. In 2010, for instance, the president was biking in Martha's Vineyard with his daughter, Malia, in some ill-fitting pants. It may seem like an insignificant matter, but at least one of Mr. Obama's political foes, former Alaska Governor Sarah Palin, seems to think that the president's jeans are hurting foreign relations. Look, the perception of Obama, of him and his potency across the world, is one of such weakness, Palin told Fox News' Sean Hannity. People are looking at Putin as one who wrestles bears and drills for oil. They look at our president as one who wears mom jeans and equivocates and bloviates. This is a very interesting way Palin has put out her ideas of Obama's pants choice and decision and how they fit him. I think this whole situation, this whole topic is kind of weird a little bit, but, you know, it is what it is. Moving on, government secrecy up under the Obama administration. Now, the Obama administration has a way to go to fulfill its promises from day one to become the most transparent administration in history. More often than never, the administration endorsed government files or outright denied access to them last year under the U.S. Freedom of Information Act, cited more legal exceptions, it just justified withholding materials and refused a record number of times to turn over files quickly that might be especially newsworthy, according to a news analysis of federal data by the Associated Press. Most agencies also took longer to answer records requests. The government's own figures from 99 federal agencies covering 6 years show that halfway through its second term, the administration has made few meaningful improvements in the way it releases records. In category after category, except for reducing numbers of old requests and a slight increase in how often it waived copying fees, the government's efforts to be more open about its activities last year were their worst since President Barack Obama took office. In a year of intense public interest over the National Security Agency's surveillance programs, the government cited national security to withhold information a record 8,496 times, a 57% increase over a year earlier and more than double Obama's first year, when it cited that reason 3,658 times. The Defense Department, including the NSA and the CIA, accounted for nearly all of those. The Agriculture Department's Farm Service Agency cited national security 6 times, the Environmental Protection Agency did twice, and National Park Service did once. And 5 years after Obama directed agencies to less frequently invoke a deliberative process exception to withhold materials describing decision-making behind the scenes, the government did it anyway a record of 81,752 times. Now, the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, whose top official has testified to Congress repeatedly about NSA surveillance programs disclosed by contractor Edward Snowden, told the AP it couldn't find any records or emails in its offices asking other federal agencies to be on the lookout for journalists to whom Snowden provided classified materials. British intelligence authorities had detained one reporter's partner for 9 hours at Heathrow Airport and questioned him under terrorism laws. Now, the openness of certain files and things like that is always under debate. I mean, you've seen that Obama's rates have gone up in his second term. It's, you know, there are things out there that shouldn't be shown. There are things that should be. So I feel like this topic is kind of dicey, back and forth, very argumentative. Now, and another note. Obamacare has been a huge debate, but Obama says that he's confident health markets will be stable with Obamacare. The administration will most likely fall short of its original enrollment goals for the new Obamacare marketplaces, but President Obama thinks enough people are enrolling to prop up the new insurance marketplace. The pool is already large enough, Mr. Obama said in an interview with the medical website WebMD published Friday. I'm confident the program will be stable. The president's remarks come amid criticism of the way his administration is handling the individual mandate, a policy that the White House says is critical to sustaining the marketplace. About 4.2 million Americans had signed up for an Obamacare plan by the end of February, and millions more are expected to sign up before open enrollment ends on March 31st. Without a sufficient pool of enrollees, the marketplace runs the risk being too small to attract sufficient competition. Additionally, too few young enrollees who tend to be healthier would cause premiums to increase for everyone in the marketplace. The president, however, told WebMD that this won't be a problem. Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius on Wednesday said that at least next year, premiums are likely to go up. With the deadline for open enrollment on the new Obamacare marketplace approaching, lawmakers are taking a closer look at the individual mandate. On Friday, the Republican-led House passed a bill that included a five-year delay of the penalty imposed on those who don't follow the mandate. The bill passed 238-181 with 12 Democrats voting in favor for it. The White House, however, has issued a veto threat against the bill. This legislation would result in higher numbers of uninsured Americans, higher premiums for those who remain insured, and fewer premium tax credits for middle-income families, and would increase cost shifting of uncompensated care to health care providers, workers, and businesses, the White House said. Conservatives counter the White House as being hypercritical. The administration itself has left open a broad window for consumers looking for exemptions from the mandate. And last week, the administration extended a policy fix for people who have been dropped from insurance plans that are no longer Obamacare compliant. That means, in part, that the administration will issue an exemption from the mandate to those who were dropped from their plans and have had trouble finding a new plan. Republicans said the administration was undermining its own policies. Now this goes back to, you know, the whole advertising of Obamacare and its support and people knowing its deadline. Now that all relates back to this and how people feel about Obamacare, whether it's people not knowing about the deadline, people not knowing about Obamacare, or people just completely not agreeing with it. The administration has responded by pointing out that from the beginning, the law included hardship exemptions. Now, everything is right now tailored to getting teenagers to get on board with Obamacare. And now, indeed, after the Obamacare marketplace is open in October, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services predicted that as many as 12 million people would apply for a hardship exemption. It's true, though, that the administration has on multiple occasions now opened up the hardship exemption to more people than initially anticipated. Last year, after it became clear several states wouldn't be expanding Medicaid services, the administration said they'd grant exemptions to people who fall in the Medicaid gap. Now, the Obama administration wants to get Obamacare out there, wants people to know what's going on with Obamacare, want people to know, to enroll for Obamacare. The March 31st open enrollment deadline is coming up, so they are doing everything possible. And you can see Congress and the White House are in back and forth debates about getting laws to tailor to what is going on with Obamacare and how people feel about it, how Congress feels about it, and what it could do to this nation. Obviously, Obama and his administration are aiming everything right now at teens with his strive to get more teens to sign up. They need more applicants, and he knows that March Madness is a great way to get people to learn about the deadline, and using LeBron James as a celebrity piece in this ad and in this marketing technique is a great way to get people on board with Obamacare, maybe make people understand Obamacare, maybe even disagree with Obamacare, but at least he is getting the deadline out there because there's a huge majority that doesn't even know of the March 31st deadline. He just wants that 31st deadline to be out there and for people to hear what he has to say about Obamacare and what Obamacare will do. Now, with that, here on Political Row with myself, DJ Liberty, we are going to take a quick short break. But please stay tuned for the last segment to continue with a couple of articles that discuss some more national news and then some state news here in California. Stay tuned. You're on the one and only radio.dominican.edu. What's up, everybody? We're back here on Political Row with DJ Liberty here on Penguin Radio. Now we're going to finish up one thing here with national news as it kind of relates to us college students, how the White House targets for-profit colleges over student debt. The Obama administration is proposing new rules designed to protect students at for-profit colleges from amassing huge debt they can't pay off and still pass judicial muster after a previous version was thrown out by a federal judge. The proposed regulations would penalize programs that produce graduates without the training needed to find a job with a salary that would enable them to pay off their debt. Schools, for profit or not, that don't comply would lose access to federal student aid programs. That's a pretty big deal. Now we'll move on here to some state news. As Republican candidates for governor highlight divisions within California's GOP. Now, booze-fueled parties hosted by Neil Kashkari and Tim Donnelly at the California Republican Party's biannual convention stretched into the early morning hours Sunday, their supporters dancing in the ballrooms within steps of each other at the other end of the conference hotel. Yet the gulf between the two candidates for governor could hardly be wider, and a weekend of campaigning laid bare not only by the differences between them, but persistent fissures within the GOP. A vocal conservative base rallied for Donnelly, the Tea Party favorite, while Kashkari lobbied a more moderate segment of the electorate, including young Republicans, minorities, and the party's donor and professional class. The division between moderate and conservative elements of the GOP is a nationwide phenomenon, but it's exacerbated here in California. Now, the Tea Party activists mobilized, building a statewide network and becoming more forceful at conventions. The same Republicans who cheered Donnelly on Sunday sang God Bless America in the hotel the previous day, and they marched through the lobby chanting, "Taxed enough already." Mike Spence, president of the Conservative Republicans of California, said, "This is a place that Kashkari doesn't understand." Neither Donnelly, a Twin Peaks assemblyman, nor Kashkari, a former Goldman Sachs executive, is favored to unseat Governor Jerry Brown in this Democratic-leaning state in which Brown has a huge fundraising advantage. But Republicans are anxious to field a credible candidate in California's highest-profile race this year. At a meeting of conservative Republicans, Donnelly, who has the endorsement of the conservative California Republican Assembly, said the GOP needs to reconnect with the church. He lamented government regulation and said, "I want my freedom back." Now, moving on, this kind of ties in with that, but Condoleezza Rice is not running. However, she does want California to rebuild. Former U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice told Republican activists Saturday that while California has always been on the leading edge of the country, the nation's most populous state is in dire need of rebranding. California has always had a certain sheen, a kind of exceptionalism of its own, Rice told a lunchtime gathering of the California Republican Party on Saturday. She urged the crowd to rebuild this party, to rebuild our nation, and to rebuild our world. Yet, in a state in which the GOP is hard-pressed to field competitive candidates for statewide office, much less win one, Rice is the highest-profile figure that just about every Republican wishes would help reshape California by running herself. Rice's remarks Saturday, which touched on everything from education to foreign policy, came as the state party looks to reverse decades of voter registration and electoral losses. The main two Republicans challenging Democratic Governor Jerry Brown, as I stated earlier, are Assemblyman Tim Donnelly and U.S. Treasury official Neil Kashkari, who face very significant odds. Rice has repeatedly said she is not interested in running for elected office, but she was mentioned as a potential vice presidential pick in 2012, and California Republicans have longed for a candidate of her caliber to run for a statewide office. And with all of this governor talk going on and campaigning and fundraising, the California campaign finance bill has been sent to Governor Jerry Brown. State lawmakers sent Governor Jerry Brown a bill Monday designed to strengthen California's campaign finance standards in response to a recent case that prompted the largest campaign reporting fine in state history. "We're going to give unchecked power to the FPPC," said Assemblyman Donald Wagner, Republican from Irvine, referring to state Fair Political Practices Commission. Unaccountable bureaucrats will have the power to launch investigations to harass candidates with absolutely no checks, absolutely no balances. The resulting publicity could doom candidates who only after the election would have the chance to clear their name if they've done nothing wrong, he and other Republicans said. The bill's author, Assemblyman Richard Gordon, a Democrat from Menlo Park, countered that the change will give the public confidence that elections are conducted fairly. His legislation responds to $15 million in anonymous donations known as dark money that was spent against Brown's successful tax increase initiative in 2012 and for separate initiative that would have limited unions' abilities to raise money for political purposes. Other provisions of the bill give regulators 2 years instead of the current 1 year to audit campaign funds and address disclosure of donations by subcontractors and sub-vendors, such as those involved in the 2012 dark money case. Candidates who leave office also would have to decide within 90 days what to do with any remaining campaign money. The bill will take effect July 1st, in time for the year's general election campaigning, if Brown signs it into law. Now that's it for me, DJ Liberty, on my show, Political Row. I want to thank you guys for tuning in and say happy St. Patrick's Day once again, and make sure everybody's safe out there today. Thank you for tuning in. You were listening to Penguin Radio on the one and only radio.dominican.edu. Thank you.